Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
The New Hampshire primary is on Tuesday. But you might be forgiven for not knowing that it's just a few days away. There are no debates, not all the candidates are even in the state, and Nikki Haley, the one person who should be risking everything to win there, seems to be playing it very safe. On the Democratic side, Joe Biden isn't on the ballot, and his two opponents, Marianne Williamson and Dean Phillips, are at worst minor irritants. But there is one bit of mystery left in the race, one that's a reminder of an era when New Hampshire was the king of the presidential nominating process, and when local media barons had enormous influence. On Sunday, the New Hampshire Union Leader, the 161-year-old conservative paper that has operated like a Republican Party boss for many decades, will issue its endorsement in the race.
And the Union Leader had quite a checkered career in terms of successful endorsements, but was always mixing it up on one side or the other or both.
Joe McQuaid was the longtime publisher of the Union Leader.
We've always gone for the person that we think has the best chance, and it's up to the voters.
And he has lived and breathed New Hampshire politics and Union Leader history ever since he was a teenager and was pressured by his social studies teacher to back LBJ instead of the candidate who had won his heart, Barry Goldwater. It may have been the last time anyone told him what to think. When McQuaid took over as publisher in 2000, after the paper had been run since the 1940s by William Loeb and his wife Naki, McQuaid became well known for blunt editorials that punched candidates in the face. George W. Bush was an empty suit. Mitt Romney was plastic and desperate. Ron Paul was from the Island of Misfit Toys. In 2016, McQuaid wrote that Donald Trump was a crude blowhard with no clear political philosophy and no deeper understanding of the important and serious role of presidents of the United States than one of the goons he lets rough up protesters in his crowds. Trump, who had originally courted McQuaid for his endorsement, returned fire by calling McQuaid a real lowlife and describing the paper as a piece of garbage.
He has no business being president of the United States.
That relationship was never repaired. In 2020, after his son Brendan took over as publisher, the Union Leader endorsed Joe Biden. Joe McQuaid still writes occasional opinion pieces. He has an encyclopedic knowledge of New Hampshire politics, and he is the ideal person to hear from if you want to understand the history of the state's primary, especially on the Republican side. I spoke to him this week while he flipped through the pages of the paper. You might hear that in the background. We talked about whether or not Nikki Haley can win on Tuesday, if she'll get the Union Leader's endorsement, how things went so far south between him and Trump, and whether or not New Hampshire's primacy in American politics has come to an end. And we talked about some of the greatest moments in New Hampshire's primary history, many of which he was on the scene to witness. This period between Iowa and New Hampshire, it feels to me very different than previous cycles when you've had a competitive primary. There are no debates. Trump is sort of off the trail. You know, half the time he's at a trial in New York. Haley seems like she's not really engaging directly with voters in the same New Hampshire tradition that we all come to expect.
I don't think that's true.
Do you think it's sort of a like the end of the New Hampshire primary we're witnessing here?
No, I think the primary has changed a great deal. I think Trump and Forbes have changed that with spending all the money on paid media. But she has a lot of campaign events. We're running a daily list now, and she has meet and greets in Keene Saturday. She has a big rally Sunday in Exeter. She has a meet and greet in Franklin on Monday. And Trump's got three things up here, three rallies in the next 3 days. I think if anything's changed, it's just that the national media spends so much time talking about the friggin' horse race, and saying things are over before they've even begun, such as in Iowa, that you don't get the feeling of excitement. You know, so far the polls have come true, right? And the polls show Trump is going to win the nomination. It's going to be him versus Biden. So I think that has changed primaries more than anything. And I can't tell you a lot of the positions of DeSantis and Haley on the issues because the stories are all about how they're doing in the polls.
Yeah.
And if there's an issue mentioned, it's down in the 20th paragraph or not at all in the National Sandinista newscasts. I got that line from Judd Gregg, National Sandinista Radio.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I think it is.
All right, so you don't buy this that we're kind of sleeping towards Tuesday. You think this is
no? There'll be some excitement, and I think there'll be some on the Democratic side too. I don't think that Biden is going to get the turnout that his people hope. I mean, think about it. You got both U.S. senators and congressmen, all of whom are Democrats, pushing a Biden write-in. You had a big press conference in which they explained to the poor, stupid voter how you write somebody's name in. Really, yeah. They did. They had graphics and everything. And I don't think there's going to be a lot. I think there are going to be some independents who say, if I'm going to vote, I'm going to see if I can make a difference on the Republican side. I have no idea the poor candidates, Williamson and Dean. Vermin Supreme has gotten as much coverage as they have.
You think that's been unfair? I'm looking at your website, the Union Leaders website right now, and I see that Dean Phillips has the banner advertising up on there. So he's clearly spending money in the state. But do you think that the Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson, the coverage of them and their challenge to Biden has been unfair from the national press?
Yeah, and the local press. They've just been written off before they began.
Yeah,
Biden's the incumbent. This is the way it's going to be, which I don't think is good. But I think the press in general are unfair to the voter by, I don't know, assuming that the voters know where the candidates stand on the issues, because Trump is ahead in the polls. Trump is ahead by this much. Trump's lead is double digit. You know,
yeah,
which is not good for our democracy.
Yeah, I was listening to Mike Murphy, who has a great podcast with David Axelrod and Robert Gibbs. And Murphy has been he doesn't love Haley herself, and I'm sure you know who Mike Murphy is. You probably don't personally. He's been very bullish on Haley. He thinks she's the last hope for never Trump guys like him. But he, as a strategist, after Iowa in one podcast, he was just not impressed with her ability to take this fight to Trump in New Hampshire. Do you share that assessment with her not quite getting the assignment here?
I'm not sure how she's going to do. I think there are an awful lot of people who don't want Trump. They're usually independent, so-called undeclared voters. And I think the Democrats are trying their best to get them, the undeclareds, to vote write-in for Biden. I think not so much for the write-in as they don't want undeclareds going on the Republican side and voting in Haley, because right. I think it's pretty clear that Haley would clean the floor with Biden. Trump is about the only guy that Biden could lose to a lot of people. Trump is the only one that Biden has a shot of beating, but neither one of them should be in it. But I think there are a lot of undeclareds, and if it's not 40 below come Tuesday, I think there'll be a good turnout on the Republican side, and it won't just be diehard Trump supporters. There'll be others, and New Hampshire's has had a way of sending the kind of message that, no, that's not the way it's going to be. And so she has a shot here. How she goes about it, and I'm sure she's getting plenty of free advice from everybody about how she should be dealing with Trump. I think for her, she's better off to do the way she's doing, which is he's of a different era. He was okay when he was in, but it's not the same anymore, and chaos follows him, et cetera. So vote for me instead. We'll see how that works.
You know, Joe, 2016, we got to talk about that because this is the turning point. And let's take a second and sort of take a trip down memory lane in 2016. You're watching this guy Trump like everyone else in 2015, probably dismissing him as you called him a crude blowhard. I think a lot of Americans would agree with that, but not so many Republicans these days. What's your, as you think back to the 2016 primary and how Trump changed things in New Hampshire, tell us a little bit about that. I know there's a lot to unpack there.
Before we called him a blowhard, he was seeking the union leader's endorsement mightily.
Tell us about that.
Well, he had come up here. It's my late wife's fault that he got to the White House, because in 2015, early on, might have been 2014, Neil Levesque, who runs the New Hampshire Institute of Politics, and has a hand in something called Politics and Eggs, which is a political breakfast. He called me up.
Institution in New Hampshire, for listeners that don't know. And
it is.
They host these forums and all the reporters go and they give you these little wooden eggs as souvenirs. I've got one sitting on a shelf right here.
Yeah, it's, you know, eggs are fine, but it's really stupid to try to get somebody's autograph on an oval wooden egg. I see people struggling with it. Anywho, Levesque calls me at my office and says, I want you to come to Politics and Eggs. The speaker is going to be Donald Trump. And I said, Levesque, I've got a perfectly good record. I've never been to one of your Politics and Eggs breakfasts. Why should I change that? And it was true. I never had. And he said—
You've never gone to one, huh? Wow.
No. Okay. No. He said—
Not your thing.
Trump asked especially for you. And I said, yeah, bullshit. He didn't. But then it occurred to me that my wife had said she loves to meet candidates. She was actually Pat Buchanan's big helper up here when he won. She had said she'd like to meet Trump if he ever came to town. So I relented, told Neil we'd come. My wife was ill. She couldn't go. My daughter went with me. We go to this thing. I've never met Trump in my life. He's sitting at the same table with me. He gets up on stage. This is a surprise, Ryan. He doesn't have a prepared speech. He's just meandering on. But every other sentence, he's pointing at me saying, am I right, Joe? Am I right? And a lady next to me says, how long have you known this guy? And I said, 22 minutes. but it occurred to me, I'm always looking, Ryan, and you be careful because you could end up on the list for a speaker for the Nacky Loeb School's annual First Amendment Honors Program. We've had about 20 of these. Jonathan Martin did it once. George Will, Liz Cheney. Anywho, I asked Trump. Yeah, well, but Trump and Biden are also on it. They both appeared, and Trump agreed to come the next year. So that was the stat when he again, he had no goddamn good remarks, but I knew then that he was going to run in 2016. And he came into the office a couple of times. And when I went out to greet him, as I did with all the candidates, he's looking over my shoulder, and I turn around, and the entire union leader staff is there. And my son said later, well, Trump is, you know, he's a rock star. He's a media guy. Everybody wants to look at him. And he's also made up this story that I didn't endorse him because he declined to play golf with me. Absolute BS. He had invited me down to Daytona a couple of times or wherever the hell his course was, and I couldn't go. And then he calls up. He was doing a no labels thing that weekend in Manchester. And he said, you want to play golf? And I said, you don't have time to play golf. You got to do this thing. I said, we can have lunch at the Derryfield Country Club, which happens to be the municipal golf course in Manchester, which is the only one I can afford to be a member of. So we ate there. And he scoffed down a cheeseburger and all the fries, took his picture with a bunch of people and left, right? I don't endorse him. He says he's just mad because I wouldn't play golf with him at his fancy golf club. Just BS. But I did make the list that year, Ryan. You probably made it since of, I think, the New York Times list of the top 20 people that Trump called names.
I've not actually been on that list, but congratulations. Tell us what he called you.
Called me a liar, a loser. The paper was going out of business that year. The usual stuff.
Yeah.
So, Trump had been up here. He had courted the idea back in 2012, I think, to run.
Yep.
But people think he was doing that for his TV shows more than anything else. But I was surprised as the next guy when in 2015 he came up and did the Nacky Loeb thing and soon said he was running. And, of course, told the crowd that I had told him that this was the biggest crowd we'd ever had for a Nacky Loeb First Amendment event, which it wasn't. But he, I don't know if you know this.
That
but
doesn't sound like him at all.
He tends to make things up. Trump was up here maybe a month ago, and Kevin Landrigan, who's the longtime State House reporter for the Union Leader and knows politics pretty well, was assigned to cover Trump and actually had an interview with Trump. And Landrigan sends me an email about this afterwards where he says, okay, it's bad enough that when I go in to see him, the first thing he says is, how's Joe? How's Joe doing? But then after the interview, he says, make sure you send my regards to Joe. I bet he's getting to play a lot more golf than I am. So I may be on Trump's good list again.
Interesting. So Trump famously, if you don't like him and have a war of words with him the way that you did, he's always willing to accept you back into the fold and always willing to believe that you could see the light and endorse him. Has that been the extent of the wooing this time around, or is it, as far as you know, has it gone further?
No, I'm going to endorse him this weekend.
You are?
No. I have nothing to do with the endorsements of the newspaper, and I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't endorse anybody.
Yeah, let's get to that in one second. I do one last thing on Trump.
There's no last things on Trump, Ryan.
Well, that's true. That's true. That's the next thing on Trump.
Yes.
Was there ever a moment that the paper considered revising its view of Trump as so many other conservative institutions have?
No, sir. No, I think he demonstrated quite colorfully and accurately our view of him when we decided we were not endorsing him in 2016. He has no business being president of the United States. He's a dangerous man, and he has a lot of sycophants, and he has a party which looks at the world today and the political landscape and has determined that they must say nice things about him or they're not going to get elected. And that's so with the people running for governor in New Hampshire this year have said they're going to support Trump if he gets the nomination. Even the very popular—
Even Sununu.
Even young Sununu, yeah.
What do you think of that decision? You like Sununu, right?
Yeah, he's, you know, I knew him when he was a kid. I knew his father better. I think it's a political calculation that he's made because to say, no, I'm not and would never endorse him, that would be used by Trump and the party against Haley, who Sununu, it's a long shot, but he's trying to get her to make a difference in New Hampshire. But it's still disappointing to me as an American citizen that people would say they're going to vote for this guy.
Has the since you stepped down at the paper in 2019, mm-hmm. has the paper been consistent in its view of Trump?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
I still write occasional editorials for the paper, and that has not changed at all.
And your son Brendan, passed the baton to him, and he has the same view. You guys share the same opinion of Trump, I assume.
Yes, sir, we do. Although Brendan doesn't talk much about that or politics, he's trying to keep a paper afloat, which is not easy these days, and he's the president of the State Press Association, dealing with legislation, et cetera. But no, we're not for Trump. But Brendan is the guy which you're going to get to this part where in 2020 we endorsed somebody, not Trump.
Who did you endorse in 2020?
Joe Biden.
And explain what a kind of shock that was to a lot of people.
Yeah, it shouldn't have been. But it was. It was my son's editorial. He showed it to me before he ran it, and he just said, "There's no question for us. Trump is still Trump, and you know, Biden had been a decent middle of the road guy on most things. He was well known to the paper, having run." Several times, not well in New Hampshire, but he was good, and he did us the service, the Naki Loeb School, the service of speaking at one of our events. I think just before he ran in 2020, so it was not a surprise. Although people were asking me when the hell was the last time we endorsed a Democrat? I look back, and in 1912, we—
1912?
Yeah. No, we—
More than 100 years.
Yeah, I don't think we endorsed one then either. But I was curious during the war, since Frank Knox was FDR's Secretary of the Navy, but had been a Republican presidential candidate in 36, what we were going to do. And I think the paper went with the— Wendell Willkie.
Hmm. Tell us about the process and explain to people when the union leader's endorsement will come out. And I know you're retired and it's in your son's hands, but I assume you have some insight into this process. And you tell us about—
You're incorrect, Ryan, and there is no process. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if there wasn't an endorsement this year.
What do you mean there's no process? In other words, it's just—
The process is always the publisher makes the call.
Yeah, yeah.
And for, you know, 40 years, it was William Loeb made the call. And his widow was more collegial and got us involved, but it was still, you know, what do you think? And I like this guy. And what she said went. And then after that, it was me. We've never had an editorial board.
Yeah.
We've had a couple of people.
No meetings. Yeah.
No, we've had meetings with the candidates. And
I mean, there's no editorial meeting where you're sitting around and there's a vote or something like that.
Nope.
And what's Brendan's process?
I don't know. I think he reads and makes up his own mind.
But surely he's talked to you about this.
No, sir, he has not.
Huh.
That's not the way it works. I got out, right?
Yeah.
It's a big operation. I could look at the paper every day and tell him and the editor at least 400 ways to make it better, because I know all. but that's not what I do. I read it, and to help my son and the guy who puts the editorial pages together, I write a couple of editorials a week, and they usually accept them. But as I say,
what if you wanted to endorse a candidate?
Well, at the local level, I think my son would, if he objected, he'd say so. But I don't think he does, and I've endorsed local candidates for the paper. But this one is in another league.
What would you do if you were still running the paper this weekend?
I would endorse Nikki Haley.
You would?
Without question. I was showing you sound.
That's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer from your point of view.
I got a lot of mail from her and very little from Ron DeSantis. In the last 2 days, I've gotten at least 8 flyers. They're very colorful. Most of them, she looks good, except the Trump one, when she doesn't look so good. I don't know what, you know, I think he wanted to say on it, she's not my type, but he was busy with other things. No, it would be a no-brainer, because Trump, for the good of the country, needs to be stopped. I think he and Biden are the two most selfish guys in America for doing this. They should let somebody living and breathing with some command of sanity rule. They're not going to. So this is the one place where somebody can stop him, and that person is clearly Haley. DeSantis has already decamped to South Carolina. He accuses Trump and Haley of running basement campaigns, but I think he's in the basement and isn't going to make it. So it's now or never. And Haley is not my idea of a perfect or close to a perfect candidate. And she has been and rightfully accused of not being strident enough on Trump. But you look at the field, and had she been more strident, like Chris Christie, she would not be a serious challenger to Trump in next Tuesday's primary. So,
yeah,
politics ain't beanbag, and she's in it to win it. She came in and talked to my son and the editors at the paper. His process may actually include asking other people for their opinions. mine was always right, so I didn't have to do that.
As far as you know, what was the opinion he came away with?
I don't know. I haven't had a chance to talk to him since.
He's been busy. Okay.
Yeah, he's busy. He lives a few blocks from me. As I say, he's got bigger fish.
Should we conference him in and ask him who he's going to endorse?
No.
How come you said, though, you think maybe there will be no endorsement?
Because I think if he was going to endorse, he might have told me.
I sent him
a note the other day when John Sununu told me to tell Brendan that he had Sununu's permission to use Iowa Picks Corn, New Hampshire Picks Presidents. And I did. And Brendan's response was, well, this is definitely the week for presidential politics. And that's all he said. So
that was it, huh? So he's a man of few words, it sounds like.
He is indeed. Yep. Yep. Huh. He's a technical whiz and trying to get the union leader into the 21st century. And
the endorsement, if it comes out as it usually, as it does, it would be Saturday.
Sunday.
Excuse me. Sorry. It comes out on Sunday. That's yeah. and that's a tradition going back a ways.
Oh no, some have been much earlier than the last week. I think this one it's tough if a candidate is banking on it because he or she usually wants to be able to pull a quote from that and use it in their commercials and their flyers, which Chris Christie did in 2016, and then 2 weeks later took the pipe and endorsed Trump. So we unendorsed Christie, which I think is the only time that's happened. We took our endorsement. We took our endorsement back on the front page.
Wow, I didn't remember that. That's.
I think
that's,
he did.
That's how. Yeah, I'm sure he did. So did your relationship with Christie ever improve after that?
Nope.
So this time around, he was not knocking on the union leader's door?
He was supposed to come in for an interview and then told them, or his manager told them, what's the point? Because I had just written an editorial the previous Sunday which said, flip, flop, flip. About Christie and his attitude towards Trump. So they said, what's the point? And they didn't show up. But 24 hours later, he was out of it anyways. So,
yeah. But so Chris, it just seems you and Christie were pretty aligned on Trump in this primary, but you just couldn't forgive him for the sins of the past and his.
Well, I don't believe him. That's his whole shtick this time is I'm the anti-Trump. I'm the only one who's anti-Trump. I'm the only one who will tell you that I'm anti-Trump. That doesn't win elections. That was his shtick, and he saw that it just didn't work. So, you know, Haley's got a tough road, and she's trying to walk the tightrope without dissing all of Trump's followers, but that she is, you know, it's a good line. You know, we need a new generation and not fight the old battles. And that's, I think, true for both Biden and Trump.
Brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Let's talk a little history.
Sure.
You can start the story wherever you want. But people who aren't familiar with the union leader as an important institution in New Hampshire and in the New Hampshire primary, how do you like to start that story?
Actually, I was talking to Lucas before you guys came on about my dad, who was the co-founder of the Sunday part of the union leader. Still goes by the name that he came up with, which was the New Hampshire Sunday News. And it had a couple of good reporters, including his brothers and a punk named Ben Bradley, who later left and went to Washington. The union leader has been a part of presidential politics since the 1940s. Matter of fact, William Loeb, the conservative knuckle-dragger who ended up owning it, was furious in 1948, when his co-publisher at the time, a guy named Leonard Finder, invited a military guy to speak in Manchester, and he tried to get the guy to run for president, 1948. Two guesses who the guy was.
Does his last name start with an E?
Exactly. And it wasn't Einstein. You did very well. Dwight Eisenhower actually came to town, spoke at a union leader forum, got a big ovation, went home and said politics wasn't for him. Took him another 4 years, and the union leader didn't endorse Eisenhower in 52. It endorsed Mr. Republican Robert Taft, and the union leader had quite a checkered career in terms of successful endorsements, but was always mixing it up on one side or the other or both. Most infamously, with a guy named Ed Muskie and something called the Canuck Letter in 1972. And Muskie pulled a truck up in front of the union leader on a snowy Saturday and demanded that William Loeb come out and go mano a mano with him. Muskie knew damn well Loeb wasn't going to be in on a Saturday, and Loeb didn't live in the state anyways. He lived in Massachusetts. And Muskie proceeded to choke up in the snow, and some people and news media reported that he was crying, and that was the end of his campaign. Our paper didn't report him crying, just said there was snow in his eyes. And I had to call William Loeb to get his reaction to being called a liar by Ed Muskie. And Loeb said, well, if he gets upset about what a little New Hampshire publisher says, I wouldn't want him in the White House with his finger on the nuclear button. And I took this down and put it in the story, not knowing that Loeb had pretty much done the same thing in 1960 with a candidate named Jack Kennedy, who had a big rally across the street from the paper. But unlike Muskie, Jack Kennedy didn't cry. Jack Kennedy said, if there's a worse newspaper and a worse publisher in these United States than the union leader and William Loeb, I can't think of them right now. He had a big crowd, and he went on to win. Loeb asked for his reaction, said, oh, spoiled little brat, I wouldn't want him in the White House. So
the Democrats would often use you guys as a sparring partner. And for media, these kind of PR events. And the Republicans would try and get your endorsement.
Some of them, yes. Some of them, no. Some of them knew they didn't have a chance, so they would wear that as a badge of honor. In 64, Loeb and the paper were all for Barry Goldwater, of course. But he and Nelson Rockefeller, and you know this, Ryan, being a student of history, they lost the New Hampshire primary not only to another candidate, but a guy whose name wasn't on the ballot. He was written in. Henry Cabot Lodge.
Yes.
He was off in Vietnam. He didn't go far after that, but write-ins are not a new thing for the New Hampshire primary.
Hey, Joe, just to remind people, a lot of our listeners know some of this history, but not all of it. Some of the younger listeners. Remind people what since you have an institutional knowledge of the New Hampshire primary going way back, remind people what it was back in the early days and when it became, you know, what was the sort of turning point for its national influence?
Well, that does go way back. Initially, in the first one in 1952, it was simply a beauty contest. People did not vote for the candidate. They voted for the delegates who were pledged to a particular candidate. That got lost in the fog, I think.
Yeah, and it was used, correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea was the bosses who ran the party like to have a little voter feedback. So they would use the primary almost the way that we use polling today, just to sort of get a sense, you know, how folks are doing out in the real world.
Yeah, I think that's true. Right from the get-go in 1952, Eisenhower's victory in the New Hampshire primary set him on the course to the White House. There had been some question about generals hadn't been big in politics for about 100 years, but Eisenhower did really well. Little known fact was on the Democratic side, it changed the trajectory of the Democrats because Harry Truman, who initially didn't even want his name on the ballot and said primaries were eyewash or something like that, he reluctantly put his name on the ballot and he lost the primary to a Senator Estes Kefauver. And within a couple of weeks, Harry Truman said, "I ain't running for another term." And that kind of thing went back and forth. LBJ did the same thing in 1968 when he wasn't on the ballot, but he had all the Democratic apparatus. He won a write-in, but Eugene McCarthy did so well as the upstart challenger that within 2 weeks of the New Hampshire primary, LBJ said, "I'm not running again. I got a war to conduct."
Did you, so you grew up with this paper in your blood, Joe?
Is that what it is?
History up close.
Yes. I didn't do a lot of the coverage, although when I became an editor, it fell to me to assign stories. And I was one of three reporters on a debate stage in Nashua, New Hampshire, this month. How many years ago is it since Reagan beat Bush? 1980.
44 years.
That was quite a show, Reagan versus Bush, while Reagan's other, the candidates that he'd invited to be on stage, he was the master politician. He had John Anderson and Phil Crane and John Connolly and Bob Dole all standing there, and Reagan has invited him to participate at the last minute in this debate, and the Nashua Telegraph is bullshit because they've got a debate with just Reagan and Bush. So the other candidates all leave, and that's where Spencer Tracy told Katharine Hepburn the truth. Now, Ryan's going, "What the hell is this old guy talking about?"
I think I know where you're going, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, I once went to the White House with my buddy John DeStazo to interview Ronald Reagan. And before we went in, we were in Marlon Fitzwater's office. He was the press secretary. And I asked Marlon if he knew if anybody had asked Reagan where Reagan got his "I'm paying for this microphone" line, because, of course, Spencer Tracy had said the same thing in a movie in 1946. And I'm damn sure Reagan called up that memory and used it to his advantage. But Marlon said, "No, nobody's asked him. And if I were you, I wouldn't ask him either. And I didn't have the guts."
That is the first time that I've ever heard that the, and we should, for listeners that don't know, Reagan at this event was someone tried to silence him, and he said, "I'm paying for this microphone." But this is the first time that I'd ever heard that there was a famous movie with the same line.
Yep. Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn. I think it was called State of the Union, and Tracy was a candidate, sort of like Wendell Willkie, trying a different approach. And he was talked into just going with the big money bags lines by the evil campaign manager and his pretty assistant.
Some things never change, huh?
Oh, no, they don't. And it sent Reagan to the White House because he was a guy that the the press was saying was too old. Geez, don't tell Biden that. And Reagan showed that he still had vim and vigor.
You started at the Union Leader in 1970, but before that, I'm sure you were involved in some of these primaries. What's your first personal memory of participating in or being aware of a New Hampshire primary?
Good question. I actually started the paper as a part-time sports reporter in 1965 when I was in high school. And the paper was already a name, and my teachers would give me a hard time for working for that terrible Neanderthal lobe. So I got beaten down. I was going to be all for Goldwater in 64. And my social studies teacher was all for LBJ. And I finally capitulated at the end and said I was for Johnson over Goldwater.
Really, just to get a better grade?
Just to survive in class. Jeez. Yeah, yeah. And so that's my first memory of presidential politics.
And after that, I had
Vance Harkey in my office seeking a news story. Remember him? He was a senator. I think he was a U.S. Senator Democrat from Iowa or Indiana, one of those flyover places. And he was one of many challenges, I think, in 72 when Gene McCarthy cleaned up. Interesting, yeah. New Hampshire
that
trivia.
That was after the Democrats changed the rules and the system was a little different after that.
Yes, yes. Well, McCarthy's campaign manager that year was a guy who had started the New Hampshire Sunday News with my dad. His name was Blair Clark. He was president of CBS News for a while, hired Dan Rather, edited The Nation magazine, big liberal. I don't know how the hell these guys got along for 2 minutes, let alone a year, before Clark bought my dad out and turned around and sold the paper to Loeb. But so politics up here, presidential, yeah, it's in the lifeblood of New Hampshire. And I don't want to get ahead of myself with you, but I think Biden did a colossally stupid thing. He was going to get South Carolina's votes anyways, but to tick off New Hampshire in this fashion, its four electoral votes could make a difference. And then
yeah, it could be a swing state.
And then he has his DNC tell the state that the primary, which all the local Democrats are pushing Biden in a write-in, the DNC says it's meaningless, the primary.
Yeah. Tell me about the history of the Union Leader's endorsements, especially in the Republican primaries. When did they start to become extremely influential? What's the history there? How early did candidates come around seeking that endorsement? And when was the sort of turning point for that being a real prize
in the
run-up to the primary?
The first ones, there was no question who Loeb was going to back, including Taft. And then in 56, he was only lukewarm for Eisenhower, and in 56,
but even in the 50s, Loeb's endorsement was. What's the history of Loeb's endorsement in the 50s? It was even as early as the 1950s. It was a significant endorsement in the New Hampshire primary.
I think so. In 1956, he and Stiles Bridges covertly organized a write-in, which kept Dick Nixon on the ticket. Huh. Eisenhower's brother and all the moderates and Sherman Adams, known as Wormy Shermy by William Loeb in editorial headlines, they couldn't stand each other. They was seriously looking at dumping Nixon in 1956 for somebody else. So Loeb and Bridges quietly, I don't know how the hell they were quiet about it, but they maneuvered a write-in Nixon's name. And Nixon did quite well, and I think that's what, among other things, convinced Eisenhower to keep him on the ticket. So in 1960, there was no question Loeb was going to be for Nixon, so and he and Rockefeller despised each other. So even though Rocky was up here, that wouldn't work out. And in 64, it was definitely Goldwater. So I think in 1968 was when Dick Nixon really coveted the union leader endorsement and sent one of his young conservative lions up to woo Mr. and Mrs. Loeb. Guy's name was Buchanan, Patrick J. Buchanan.
Yes, sir.
He was.
Loeb loved him.
Oh, yes, and Mrs. Loeb loved him too. He was sent up to Loeb's North Shore, Massachusetts home to woo him, and he did a pretty good job of it. So,
And how early was that in the process?
Back in the day, you know, it probably wasn't until late summer of the preceding year, 67.
Let's pause on the Buchanan 92 piece, because that, in hindsight, I think that election and the Buchanan run becomes more historically significant. And I say that for two reasons. One, the challenge to a sitting president obviously hurt George H.W. Bush, and your endorsement was the union leader's endorsement was very influential. And Bush, the New Hampshire primary was pretty difficult for Bush as he was running for re-election. I think he, if I'm not mistaken, he blamed that primary challenge, and at least historians have pointed to that primary challenge as weakening Bush and maybe helping elect Clinton. You might have a different view of that. But then, of course, I think the Pat Buchanan's politics, after being everyone thinking they were sort of extinguished in the Republican Party, have become a part of the Trump DNA. So there's a lot there to unpack, but let's talk about the 92 endorsement. Did Loeb, and do you see that as being one of the most important endorsements of the paper's history?
Yeah, it wasn't. Loeb was dead and gone by then.
He was gone. Excuse me.
He died in 1981. It was his widow, Naki Scripps.
Naki.
Loeb.
Sorry.
Naki, who was in love with Patrick J. Buchanan and encouraged him from the get-go. He came up for a lunch with her and a couple of the editors, and she was all in, I think, before.
You replaced Naki, just so listeners understand, right?
Yep. Yep. Okay. She died in 2000, and I became publisher until I retired 5 years ago. But she was all in for him, and our editorial writer of many years, a guy named Jim Finnegan, just pounded the hell out of Bush and promoted Buchanan in the editorial pages
Did Finnegan, I don't know this history as much. I mean, your editorials are known for being pretty pretty blunt. Did Finnegan sort of develop the style and language of the union leaders' famous editorials?
No, that was definitely Bill Loeb on the front page.
And so was Finnegan sort of channeling Loeb?
Yes, and doing it quite well. And Finnegan was much the better writer than Loeb. Loeb actually, he would dictate the editorials to one of his five secretaries off the top of his head, and he would have an editor look at them, but don't change anything. And that's the way they ran. And they ran on and on and on. I have memos where he chastises me for letting a story run too long. And it's next to an editorial that starts on the front and takes up the whole inside page. And Loeb didn't start out that way, but the national media started coming up here with the presidential primary, and they took note of Loeb's very salty, blustery style. And so that's why he kept at it. He didn't used to have an editorial on the front page every day of the week except for Sundays until he saw the national press picking up what he wrote. So then he had an editorial.
That's fascinating.
Every
the
day.
National press helped. The national press really helped make the union leaders' editorial writing a bigger deal.
Yes,
there
sir.
Was a kind of feedback effect.
Yes, sir. They did, and oftentimes, you know, in a critical fashion. But that didn't bother Loeb as long as his easy to spell name was spelled correctly. he loved it.
Remind people what his politics were, and if you can, sort of help us understand the history of the conservatism of the union leader.
Very conservative, very anti-communism. Yeah. First and foremost, defense, second foremost. And people have asked me, what would Loeb today think about Trump? He wouldn't be for Trump. Loeb's godfather was a guy named Teddy Roosevelt. Loeb's father was Teddy Roosevelt's chief assistant in the White House. I think Loeb would be appalled at Trump and what he has done to the Republican Party. So it was very conservative, very anti-communist, very strident. On the pro-life issue, which didn't have, a lot of impetus until the Supreme Court Roe versus Wade decision, Loeb rarely talked about it. Finnegan, good Catholic boy, very, very pro-life, anti-abortion. Loeb, not so much.
Let me ask you about some of the candidates you've met over the years. So you, who is your favorite Democrat that's ever swung by the offices or that you got to know? Or did the Democrats just stop even coming by at a certain point?
Some of them did, some of them didn't. Chris Christie wouldn't show up this time. Of course, 24 hours later, he was gone from the race. Democrats don't immediately pop to mind. I was a kid. I was a kid for Kennedy, and I never met Goldwater and... In the 70s, it was all about the Republicans. My favorite Republican candidate was Reagan, because he was a very smiling, down-to-earth figure. And his campaign chairman up here was a guy named Jerry Carman, who just passed away. And Jerry called me on a Friday night just before the primary and said they had an event going on in Milford and they would have one in the Seacoast, but something else fell through. So that afternoon, could I put something on in Candia for Ronald Reagan? Christ. Huh. I said, the school's closed. I don't know the janitor's phone number. I suppose my mother could have a coffee in her living room, whereupon my wife, who was in the room with me, looked at me like, are you nuts? But I called my mother, was okay with her. I called the paper, put a paragraph in on page 3, and by 2 o'clock the next afternoon, half of Candia was in my mother's living room. And they waited and waited, and Reagan didn't show up. And the campaign called and said, he's late, but he'll be there. Another hour goes by, no Reagan. Jerry Carman calls me at my mother's house. Put your mother on. The candidate would like to talk to her, but he's not going to be able to make it. I said, my mother does not want to speak to the candidate. My mother hardly knows the guy. But if he's not here within an hour, I'm going to have William Loeb endorse George Bush instead of Reagan, which I had no authority to say and it wouldn't go over. But long story short, Reagan showed up in my mother's living room at about 4:30 in a very snowy Saturday afternoon, picked up my one-year-old daughter, who gave him a big kiss. And Reagan says, that's a switch. It's usually the candidate who kisses the baby. But he shook hands. He was very down to earth. Everybody loved him.
Thanks for doing this. Thanks for spending so much time. I'll see you up there this weekend,
good.
And I'll be bugging you either way. And
take care.
If you get a heads up on what Brendan's going to do,
let us know.
Thank you, Joe.
I'll ask him. Take care.
And that's our show. Our producer is Kara Tabor. Our senior producer is Alex Keeney. I'm Ryan Lizza, host and executive producer of Deep Dive. Our music is by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Thank you to Lucas Randall Owens for field production in New Hampshire this week. Please tell us what you think about the show or who you'd like to hear on Deep Dive. You can email me at rlizza@politico.com. And please subscribe to Playbook Deep Dive wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Thank you.